This podcast is in promotion of 221 Beacon in Atlanta, Georgia. You can find all the information you need at www.221beacon.com. All recordings were live at the panels, and all attendees, in accepting their badge and in consideration of being admitted to 221 Beacon, consented to being photographed on film, tape, or digital for exhibition in all media. Their badge also authorized and permitted 221 Beacon and its designees to use his or her name, voice, and likeness in all reproduction thereof in all media, nor hereafter known for all purposes in perpetuity. This panel was called Watsons Through Time, which myself was on, as well as some other fabulous people who will introduce themselves during the recording. I hope you enjoy. It's a lot of fun. And yeah, go to 221 Beacon. Hello, everyone. I would just like to take a moment to thank our sponsors. First off is Gasogene Books, which is the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They've assembled a broad array of titles sure to appeal to the discriminating reader. Whether you've just discovered the great detective or you're a seasoned Sherlockian, you're sure to find many unique volumes to pique your interest. Take a few moments to check out their website at www.wessexpress.com and browse through their titles. And once you've made your selection, ordering is just an easy few clicks of your mouse. Click, click. Also, the Baker Street Journal. It continues to be the leading Sherlockian publication since its founding in 1946 by Edgar W. Smith. With both serious scholarship and articles that play the game, the journal is essential reading for anyone interested in Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle, and the world where it is always 1895. Not yet a subscriber? Subscribe today to the most respected source of Sherlockian scholarship. More details can be found at www.bakerstreetjournal.com. Also, make sure to follow them on Twitter at BakerSTJournal for fun facts every single day with quotes from the canon and all sorts of things. And last but not least, the Scintillation of Scions. The Scintillation is an annual symposium of fans for Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, sponsored by Watson's Tin Box in Maryland. The event includes speakers and attendees from around the U.S. as well as local Sherlockians. The tradition they have established is to have at least one first-time presenter in order to offer an opportunity for them to have the experience of public speaking and to a friendly crowd. This year's Scintillation has passed, but go to www.scintillation.org to find out about next year's and more events at Watson's Tin Box. Are you interested in becoming a sponsor? Get in touch by emailing us at info@bakerstreetbabes.com.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you 221 be mine?
We're here to talk about John Watson. Yes. So I guess we'll go around and we'll introduce ourselves,
and then we'll start talking about the delicious army doctor thing.
Oh, good. Someone went there before I could.
Go ahead.
I'm Roan. I'm basically sitting here because I'm an enormous John Watson fangirl. And I think the biggest question that I would love to talk about is, I mean, the revelation for me seeing BBC Sherlock was, but wait a minute, I thought John was a bumbling idiot. Because that was my exposure. And I'm really curious. And I went back and started reading the canon and went, no, but he wasn't.
Oh, I have lots of opinions on that.
So, yeah, I would really love to look at when that shift happened.
Yep.
Oh, yes.
Totally. I am Christina. I run the Baker Street Babes podcast. And, yay, thank you. Cheers. And, yes, I was a Sherlock girl all my life. And then I'm slowly being converted to Watsonism. So,
this come is, to our son.
This is part of my 12 steps.
Wait, it took 12 steps? It's not taken...
17. I'm sorry.
Oh.
I got it. I'm Ashley. I'm doing a
PhD on Sherlock Holmes adaptations. My master's thesis was the evolution of John Watson on screen. So panel is sort of my thing. Yes, and I am, my grandmother, now deceased, are the only two people in the world, I think, who have read it all the way through. My mother got to page 32 and quit. It sat on the kitchen table for like 3 months. So anyhow, hopefully I'll get some of those ideas out into the air at long last.
Yes.
My name is Eddie Webb. I'm a local video game writer, but I also went through and reviewed every single story in the canon on my blog, which I'm compiling into a manuscript whose title is Watson's Not an Idiot.
Yeah,
I have opinions on this subject.
All right, so we actually have a few things to give away during the panel, so we're going to ask some questions. So I think maybe to start off, which adaptation of Watson made him a bumbling idiot?
That's all right.
Yeah, and who played? Yes, here,
wow.
You get a button.
Oh, Nigel Bruce.
Yeah, let's talk about Nigel Bruce.
I would love to talk about Nigel Bruce because I think I'm going to be his defender on this panel.
Okay, first of all, there are two Nigel Bruce Watsons. There's the radio and the
movie. Defending the film version.
Wow, really?
Absolutely.
Yes. All right, so.
I mean, he's cute.
No. Here's the thing. Up until 1939, no actor playing John Watson had ever received top billing. None. The camera became the narrator, took over the Watson function in adaptations, and nobody could figure out what the hell to do with Watson, so he didn't even appear in all the adaptations. In 1939, even though he's not playing the Watson that you want him to play, he's playing Watson on screen, and through those adaptations, and from that point forward, he was absolutely indispensable. Every adaptation, we could not imagine Watson not
because
of Nigel
Bruce. I will concede the fact that Nigel Bruce and Basil Rathbone are entwined. You cannot have one without the other in those adaptations. Mm-hmm. Basil Rathbone is, to be perfectly honest, not that dynamic of an actor. And Nigel Bruce draws that out of him in a chemistry that's really hard. I would concede that. That being said, the damage he has done to the popular culture perception of Watson is unforgivable.
Yeah.
And to be fair, Watson's right, not the act.
There would be no popular culture perception of the character of Watson beyond the canon without him.
And again, as much as I like to bring Nigel Bruce, the reality is it's the writers that are at fault.
I'm going to the mat on this one.
How to have... It's very easy as a writer to say, have someone say, my God, this completely obvious thing is amazing to me. I mean, so as a writer... It's very easy to use Watson as a fop to make Holmes look great, even when you're not writing fantastic stuff for Holmes.
Well, I was actually talking about this with a friend of mine here, who is also a John Watson expert, whom I could call on.
Very, very
good host. We were talking about when that shift happened and why.
Right.
And we were wondering too if like the Hollywood-ish culture of the time, you had to have a dumb sidekick.
That was something we actually talked about at the original canon panel, was the fact that for American audiences, they needed that gateway to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And the idea then, which I can't really argue against, is that Watson was the American audience viewpoint in the 30s and 40s for the movie audience.
You're way off on
this point. Okay, the first two movies they made together, Watson wasn't a complete bobbling idiot.
Correct.
Okay, then it changed. The World War occurred. Mm-hmm. And you got to understand, Britain was being bombed. America wasn't. Mm-hmm. We were talking about this in another panel earlier. And Watson's character was changed to be more bumbling, more humorous, because those people were under intense pressure. You can't take it out of its time. Yet today he would look like a bumbling idiot. And the purpose of the Brett Show, one of the purposes was to bring Watson up.
No, absolutely.
No, we're actually on the same side. I'm just saying it differently.
I'm saying the first two times he performed it, he wasn't a complete bubbling idiot.
Right, but what I was saying...
The change of script writers and change of things changed.
Right, but I'm with you. What I'm actually saying is, you know, historically, that he became that because that's what people expected and wanted.
No, I think it was because of the attitude of the war.
Okay, well, we're saying the same thing.
Yeah. Watson, there's some argument, maybe the Granada, maybe Robert Duvall's version of Saturday Night Solution, but until then, he was never a peer. He was never remotely a peer. And that's not consistent with the canon. The canon is that Watson underrates his own abilities to make his friend look better. Whereas the adaptations, particularly radio adaptations, but the film adaptations as well, he is seen as explicitly inferior to Holmes. Not to the Lestrade level of idiocy, which is a whole separate branch of Galvan's.
Even Nigel Bruce makes fun of Lestrade.
Yes, right. When the guy who's supposed to be the dumb guy going, that guy's an idiot, it's like, Jesus Christ, Lestrade, you poor man. But there is a valid point that Watson, while he does slide further during some of those adaptations, he doesn't start off great.
He doesn't. He's not brilliant in How to the Baskervilles or Adventures. He's not a brilliant man. But the thing is that there needed to be a catalyst to make people realize that Watson is indispensable, and Nigel Bruce was that catalyst. The process of adaptation since then has been a process of rehabilitating and trying to slot him into place. And in my thesis, my argument actually is I go through subsequent Hound of the Baskervilles and actually identify exactly what role Watson is playing in each version, and it's slowly growing. So he starts out as a comic foil. He becomes an aide-de-camp in the Hammer Hound against Peter Cushing in the BBC series of the 60s. He was like a surrogate for Holmes rather than an aide-de-camp. He wasn't just taking dictation. He was going in and playing the Holmes role when Holmes was absent. Then he became a sort of... there was the Ian Richardson version of Hound where he was like a best friend, like a buddy.
Yeah.
And then I call him a life partner in the Brett version. because there's an emotional connection that's necessary there, and we get that triggered for us, and we haven't been able to go back since then. With each one of these steps, it becomes impossible to view the previous version of Watson as acceptable enough.
Right.
And so we get Bruce, and then it's no longer acceptable to have no Watson. Once we get Andre Morales, Bruce is no longer acceptable. We get you know, point by point, Nigel Stock, then Andre Morel is not good enough. Once you get to David Burke, or excuse me, Edward Hardwick, who is in the Hound there, it's not okay to have a Watson who is not emotionally connected to Holmes. And at this point, we have now a Watson who is an agent of justice and an arbiter of good and absolutely necessary in helping to manage Holmes. Like, he couldn't exist without him or function
like
without him.
A moral compass.
A moral compass. The moral,
which is really scary if you think about it.
That's right. That's really. The moral agent is what I called the Watson in the Matt Frewer version.
No cussing.
I forgot about that. There was therapy on the brain.
He becomes the moral agent, and then he becomes the arbiter of justice, where he actually, in the Hound from 2001, which was with what's his face?
I choose
Richard
not to remember
Roxburgh.
It.
Richard Roxburgh, thanks you. There's the wonderful moment where it's absolutely non-canonical, where he says somewhere in the middle, "Don't you trust me?" And at the very end, Watson says, "No," and Holmes says, "What?" And he goes, "No, I don't trust you." And at that moment, Watson almost supersedes Holmes as the hero character in the story, and that's where we are now. But it started.
There was a blip in there. We had Ben Kingsley. He superseded Holmes as a Watson.
Well, but yes, that's the premise of that film. If you haven't seen Without a Crew, talk about it.
Canonical adaptations,
so
though. Canonical adaptations,
yeah,
though.
Yeah,
I'm talking about how do you take the Watson from the canon and put him on screen?
Right.
It's the perpetual challenge of Sherlock Holmes.
Obviously not.
You know, it's the perpetual challenge. How do you put canon Watson on screen? It's very hard.
Yeah. It is hard, because being the sidekick is always hard, because there's always, like, that hero mentality, that hero character. But I think what's definitely happening now is that they're balancing out very well, and they become a duo rather than just one and that other guy.
Well, that's a pretty specific question. I'm curious what you guys think. Do you feel that over time, it's kind of related, Holmes has slightly lessened as a character to give room for Watson?
Absolutely true.
Because I'm finding that Holmes is becoming... Holmes has a very strong moral compass in the canon, but adaptations, he's becoming more and more abstract and removed, and Watson's filling in that humanity, which the canon Holmes did have.
He's going down. He's becoming a sort of anti-heroic character. So you have a Holmes, say, in the Matt Frewer and the Richard Roxburgh, who is willing to put people in harm's way without asking their permission first,
right,
which is something that previous Holmeses and canon Holmes doesn't do. And... So that it is, there's a sort of, and Watson has to say, Watson has to keep him honest. You can't put those people in danger. And Martin Freeman's Watson does that. Don't you recognize these people are in danger? Well, will my caring help? Then shut up. But you need Watson to be able to say,
exactly.
But people are in danger. There are real people's lives at stake.
I think the anti-hero thing is very indicative of the time. They're very into the anti-hero,
sure.
The bad boy right now.
Right.
Well, I think also, too, we kind of make this divide between the pure scientific, rational mind and the emotional part. And, you know, we no longer feel quite as comfortable putting them into the same person.
True, but as Victorian, the idea was you have both. Mm-hmm. And in modern day, we kind of divorce us a bit more, I think.
Yeah.
You have a comment? Question?
I was going to say, with the, like, Holmes becoming the anti-hero, like, coming down, like, the moral compass, I think at least the intent of the BBC series is to bring that back up as well.
Oh, totally.
Because he's such, this is Sherlock Holmes as a younger man.
Yeah.
Maybe if they had met earlier, John Watson would have taught him more of a moral compass, and then he becomes the man we see as canon.
No, totally, and I think that's what they're trying to do with the arc of his emotional development, I suppose I even say, which I think is really interesting. Yeah.
I'm researching something as we're talking. I'm glad I'm listening. I'm not just zoning out randomly. I'm researching something else.
You're researching as we speak.
Yeah, it's certainly. I do this all the time. I really don't know. So back to Nigel Bruce. One thing that I find interesting about the Magicverse interpretation, specifically the radio version, the reason why I find the radio version more palatable, and I think speaks to something that's missing later Watsonians before Granada series, is that he's explicitly the narrator of the radio show.
Yes.
He invites the literal narrator into his home. There's actually a brief part at the beginning where they talk about the case they're going to discuss, and The posit is that Watson's alive and Holmes is dead at this point in the picture. And the sheer wistfulness in Nigel Bruce's voice when he has his pieces redeems a lot for me personally, because the actual portrayal of the character in those I don't like, but the affection he has for his friend in lines that are fairly obviously, and this is the case we're going to talk about here, is actually pretty amazing for the time period and for the screen limitations he's working with him. So I do feel that Nigel Bruce brings a lot to the character in subtle ways, but I believe the writing of the character at the time, because you said, I mean, we have a superhuman character, you can't fit a peer in with that. There's no room for a Watson character to fit until you detract Holmes down.
The practical challenge of radio and of film, they're different, though, because radio still allows for a narrator. And
right.
In film, the camera narrates. So Watson doesn't need to do that. And if you take away Watson's narrative function from the canon, you're left to question how you rebuild a complete character with what's left. And that's the challenge on screen.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And they've done a wonderful job by rehabilitating the narrator function with BBC Sherlock, because he keeps
literally
the blog.
Blogger,
the blogger, so he's now a narrator again. Now, he's not narrating the story to us, the viewer, but he is narrating Sherlock's story and his story to the world at large.
Boswell once again, but he's not Boswell to us.
Right, yeah. But he's Boswell in that he's writing for the Strand. He's writing for the audience within the fiction, which is a wonderful rehabilitation of that function.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really, they've managed to do that in a way that wouldn't have made sense pre- you know, modern media, really. It would be really boring to see, you know, to come into a television episode with every episode Watson is there, you know, trying to write out the story. No, they did it a little bit in Granada, where he's trying to come up with titles and things, but not...
That's about it.
Yeah, it's very difficult to do that because you don't have the immediacy of the interwebs, which is helpful.
Yeah. All right, so next question for the next button. Who were the two actors that played Watson in the Granada series? Hands.
Did you
say
David
Burke
and Edward Hardwick?
Yes. Button! The question, sorry, I should be more clear. It was, who were the two actors to play Watson in the Granada series? Which is Edward Hardwick and David Burke.
Which one do you prefer?
David Burke.
Yep.
I disagree.
Really? Get the button back.
Give me the button. Yes, you may
not
say
why. Please, I'm curious.
Because if you watch the acting styles, I often find that it seems like Jeremy Brett and David Burke are both trying to channel an 1895 theatrical presentation. It feels like David Burke is competing with Brett in their acting style.
Really?
Whereas Edward Hardwick came in and completely played it much, much more like Martin Freeman, which is very undertone. Yeah. Allow Brett to sort of chew the scenery.
I actually like Edward Hardwick better, too.
I love David Brooks' expressions.
Yeah.
He's just the most jovial Watson.
No, because they're both acting really, really, really hard.
Right. Physically, yeah. I think David Burke is probably more a traditional Watson. Edward Hardwick is so, but in a weird way, rechanneling Madame Bruce from his age, because you then have, you know, suddenly you really, really aged after Sherlock
The hiatus was not good to him.
it forced him to regenerate.
But the balance, I keep joking, it went to an AC/DC kind of.
They're very different.
Much more like ABC Sherlock.
Well, I'm curious then. Would you then argue that, because really, even in the canon, Watson does evolve. I mean, and pretty explicitly evolves. And there is a young Watson and an old Watson kind of template. Young Watson is both massively in awe of Sherlock and also going to butt heads with him because. There's this guy who shoots people or shoots the wall at my apartment. And how the hell can I live with this guy? That's very much the young Watson problems. Hashtag young Watson problems. Whereas post-hiatus Watson has, after you know your friend comes back from the dead,
your wife
but they
get so
quickly into this kind of very comfortable relationship where
all of them.
Right. Well, the multiple wives of Watson. I'll get to in a second. But yes, I mean, he's buried and or possibly grieving his wife's demise. And you have this much more comfortable relationship where he still challenges Holmes more consistently, but in a less antagonistic way. The banter about Watson's journals, for example, or his memoirs, become a little more playful in tone. But, you know, he's still calling Watson shit out and talking about him. So it may be a bit odd to say that David Burke's very much representative of that kind of early Watson, that the kind of dynamism, and then maybe Hardwick's much more of the kind of more comfortable role of the established friendship Watson. That may be a valid way of interpreting it.
I think that's fair.
Yeah, I think Hardwick is verifiably and quantifiably less in awe of Jeremy Sherlock than David Burke is. And if you like an odd, adorably odd Watson,
he's so adorable,
then David Burke is for
really
you.
Is.
And if you prefer a Watson who sort of, you know, sits back and kind of does
so
yes, dear. It's a yes,
stuff.
Dear. That's why
it
I call him
yes,
a life
dear.
Partner.
Well, my favorite
is a yes, dear Watson.
One of my favorite Hardwick scenes, admittedly, is the one where he's fishing and it's like, and Holmes is like going, hey, you know what? It's like, yep, fishing. It's like, cool, I'm going to go okay. Come with me. It's like, really? His face is like,
I'm fishing. I can roll in like, I got fish to catch.
This is the universal gesture for fishing. Also, drum playing.
I thought I saw a hand.
And making sushi.
Edward Hardwick's relationship with Jeremy Brett is a lot more important in their Holmes and Watson relationship than a close relationship between David Burke and Jeremy Brett.
Well, they still had a very close relationship, but yeah.
That's a good point.
Yeah, the fact that David Brooke chose to leave to spend time with his family.
I wondered about that.
Yeah, well, it's
why
interesting.
Why did he go?
Because he had a son, who is Tom Brooke. So if any of you have seen Third Star, Tom Brooke is David Brooke's son, who plays...
Oh,
yeah.
Didn't know that.
There's only 7 actors in Britain.
And they've all been on Doctor Who.
You know, you know the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, 1 degree of Alan Rickman.
Because I know Rose going to extract this out of me, but Power staring at me. Okay, I'm very cognizant of the fact that my chair is down there and your chair is up there. So how about
it's
I
okay.
phrase it, because I think that you guys are better qualified than I. To speak a little bit about the first couple of paragraphs of studying Scarlet. And sort of what that meant to a contemporary reader.
The first couple of chapters? Or paragraphs or chapters?
A couple of paragraphs of A Study in Scarlet and sort of the contemporary. I think that Conan Doyle is signaling very clearly to the reader what Watson is for, essentially. You're looking at me blankly.
No. I feel like you are. That's such a specific question that I feel like you have something that's
exactly.
sort of an answer. And I would love for you to share your
I'm
answer with us.
So far talking, so.
When you've had enough of this nonsense.
No, please.
I think that the thing that has really gotten lost, I think, Conan Doyle, the very first pitch that he makes in these stories is he tells you that Watson has survived the Battle of Minnowas. Mm-hmm. And to the contemporary reader, that is like Watson, he is the action hero. He is the military survivor of this disaster. I mean, this is the British public, this was, you know, I mean, the nearest sort of parallel that I've never come up with in the American experience is the Battle of Mogadishu, which is what Black Hawk Down was based on. That you had 2,500 British soldiers who are just basically doing Afghanistan like the front room, and they are completely wiped out. But this is not, there's barely a battle. It turns into this 2-day retreat on foot to Kandahar with the wounded being killed by Afghani women and children. There's then a siege in Kandahar until they can get a relief force out of the vault. So to the contemporary reader, when they start reading the Sherlock Holmes story, and the first thing they hear is that Watson is this man who has survived this experience straight.
And actually, kind of tied to that, I wrote for here one
just,
sentence.
So they're sort of like, and I'm going to try and keep this really short. I think that it speaks also to the extent that there's a kind of a gendering of the pair to begin with, which to the Victorian reader would seem that Watson is the man. He is the fair, he has been at war, and that it's Holmes, this dark, slender, mysterious. This to a Victorian reader is very much that Watson is the observer, Sherlock is the observed. Watson is sort of, this circuitous round trip. That's a very gendered setup. Perhaps not explicitly to the reader, but it is flavored in that way.
Well, since you mentioned
the take on it was just that a reader would just get through the first couple of sentences that I survived the whole thing, and they're like, okay.
And they would go, John Watson is a bamf.
Right. Yes. Again, you mentioned the first paragraphs, and I have it here, but there's one sentence in here that I think in that section really defines Watson's character in a way that sometimes gets lost is, the campaign brought honors and promotion to many, but for me it had nothing but misfortune and disaster. And that right there is John Watson.
Yes.
In one sentence.
He misses his own regiment, and so he ends up with the Berkshires.
Right.
There was no Berkshires after the Battle of Mont. They had lost so many people that they did not attempt to remand the regiment.
But also, this is a man who not only has a capability, but he has a deep humanity and almost a depression at certain times.
Well, he is. I mean, at the beginning of Study in Scarlet, he's horribly depressed.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that, obviously he evolves as the relationship evolves, but I think it's important to note that, just like I said, first page, we have a man who's going, we did this work that I thought was right, but I'm still upset that I had to be a part of that.
I think it's even, because you're kind of pitching that on a personal level. A lot of people would pin Milan as the beginning of the end of the British public's support for imperial adventures.
Okay.
That it was the first time where they just got kicked.
Party foul.
Keep going. It's not that fast, it's just one.
The people would see it as being, I think that the reader looks at it, and not that they're sort of thinking, oh, well, this is kind of a very much contemporary frame where we think about soldiers having sort of, their individual guilt about this thing, whereas to the reading public, I know what I'm trying to say, to the reading public, this John Watson who had been in Rwanda and come back broken and received nothing for it, that was the guilt of the Imperial War, like walking in the street to the reading public, that he is what they have already done wrong.
So what's the metaphor for Imperial guilt?
PTSD.
Well, yes, which Moffat definitely plays into correctly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think obviously, for Doyle, there was that didn't exist. Nobody knew what that was. But I think that's another one of the brilliant ways that Moffat and Gatiss have brought it forward is, we know now about PTSD. And so they were able to incorporate that into our, the modern John Watson.
Well, one thing that's interesting is because Doyle was a doctor, there's a lot of things he talks about and how characters act and relate to each other that we have since discovered are actually mental illnesses that didn't exist at that time.
Yeah.
Because he was such an observer of people as part of his medical practice, he was able to extrapolate these things in his fiction and then we go, oh, that's a real thing. And so PTSD certainly is something that Watson struggles with, but you're right, there's no term for it.
Right.
But it's very spelled out in a way that would map almost directly to a PTSD patient now. So it's certainly a testament to Doyle's writing and also his observation on a personal level to be able to embed these in a way that didn't have words for them until much later we go, oh, that's what that thing was.
Well, and at that point, to have that kind of damage from war does kind of masculinize. You're a tough man.
Yeah.
If you've been through this, and now many soldiers feel like if they admit to PTSD, they've been feminized. And I think you can see a shade of that in Moffat's John Watson. We have to man him up by getting rid of his PhD.
But you can also see that in the original canon, too, because, Watson is upset that he's, has no money. He's forced to live in London, which he, in the first, in Sean and Sherry, he hates London. It takes a while before that relationship with London goes, but first, Watson hates being in London. And he hates being on the dole, as it were. You know, he hates having the fact that he is under money. But he can't say anything about it, he feels, which is why I'll shack up with this guy I've never seen before, because at least it gets me out of my problem, because I can't admit to my family that I'm in this bad of a situation.
I think it's a slight misstatement to say that BBC Sherlock has gotten, you know, the whole thing of getting rid of the cane was somehow fixing John's PTSD. I mean...
Well, it's back. You can see at the end of the Reichenbach fall that he's, like, limping again.
Yeah, but I think that's too simple. I mean, because the fact that John is running around with Sherlock is a personification of his PTSD.
Yes.
I mean, because, you know, it's the kind of the counterphobic thing of, you know, I'm now so accustomed to combat, I can't live without it, without being a wreck. You know, it's like what Mycroft says, you know, you see the battlefield, and Mycroft nailed it. I mean, that's absolutely true.
You miss it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he, and I think, I mean, my personal theory is that's why when we get to season 3, that we'll see John has kind of fallen apart again, because he doesn't have that constant stimulation that, you know, he needs to feel normal.
Well, then actually, a question that maybe you might be able to answer better is there another interpretation of Watson that addresses that beside Moffat?
Well, I was thinking about this as you guys were talking. I was listening with one ear and thinking with the other ear.
You're thinking.
I put on my thinking ears. Anyhow, it's interesting that it's not just that it's not evident in other adaptations, but I think that there's a clear reason for that, and that is that it's very rare that Study in Scarlet is adapted. I mean, texts that are directly adapted, and it's not just knowing Watson's background, but we usually, because it's a serialized story, you know, the stories were serialized, you can jump in anywhere and you can consume one short story out of context, and it doesn't matter because there really isn't a larger context. We write one in as fans. We write a larger arc in. But Conan Doyle didn't write a larger arc in, really. He didn't mean to.
He didn't do a lot of things.
So, and that's fine, but what it means is that often the fact that there's an origin story, Study in Scarlet is an origin story, where they meet, and you get to meet Sherlock with Watson. That scene is almost never filmed.
That's
ever.
A shame.
The Russian
that.
One is probably
the Russian
one that
Russian,
not only has the meeting, but has the injury mentioned, and Sherlock making mention of people avoid it while they're boxing.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. There were very few, but you're right, that does
my
it.
My favorite Watson's too.
Lily Sullivan. Yes. How many of you have seen, like, the Russian Sherlock Holmes series? Pretty good enough. But watch it.
Like, awesome.
It's so good.
I've heard really good things about
most cuddly Watson ever. They snuggle in the back of a cab. Like, that's like true.
What?
They do. After they snuggle in the back of a cab. It's like full on.
They go to concerts together. I mean,
it's lovely.
It's a total bromance.
But it's a total bromance.
Interestingly,
yes, because there's no bromance in the
BBC. You get a more complex relationship in that.
We all agree. There's no subtext there at all.
It's all text.
Point.
Oh wait.
Especially the pilot. The pilot is not subtext.
You get a more complex relationship there in that adaptation, just as you get a more complex relationship in BBC Sherlock, and it may be because we were present for that moment. It's not. You know, it's not provable with a sample size of 2 is not enough. But I think it's a reasonable theory to say that as an audience, if we come in at the beginning of their adventures, we develop with their relationship.
Exactly.
Rather than jumping in the middle, they know things about each other and themselves that we never get to find out.
And it's because that meeting scene is acting as a marker for the writer's intent. If the writers think it's important enough to show you the meaning of this relationship, then they're carrying a premium on
and
the
I think that. And I think it's indicative because Moffat is a Holmes fan, a very rabid one. He's like, no, this is important, whereas something like, say, the Robert Downey Jr. interpretation, which people who were respectful of the canon in various different ways, but didn't thought that same was necessary. They go, well, everyone knows Holmes and Watson, so let's just dive right into basically kind of a, you know, right between Study in Scarlet and Scandal Bohemia era for them.
It's the difference between telling Sherlock Holmes stories and telling Sherlock Holmes's story. There's a difference between them, and I love all adaptations, as I always say, they're job security for me. But the Robert Downey Jr. films are telling Sherlock Holmes stories,
right?
And the BBC show is telling Sherlock's Holmes's story, which is different.
Yeah. Before we go on, there was a comment.
And that was sort of my point, that I think there's a difference in when you're making something like the Robert Downey Jr. film, and I think part of the reason that so many adaptations of Holmes get off the ground is you have this great cultural base.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, you have people, ready made. Even if they've never read it, they're
right.
familiar, like, I know basically who Sherlock Holmes is, I know basically who Watson is, but I agree that if you do adapt Study in Scarlet, you have this opportunity to kind of get that very catalyst moment.
Yeah. And another point I think is fair is that I think another reason why maybe Study in Scarlet isn't adapted is because, frankly, it's a really terrible story.
Well, yes.
The first two chapters are amazing, and then it goes really down to
well, if you cut out the Mormon section.
I was going to say, this fic needs less Mormon.
Well, say okay. Less Mormon aside, if you even look at it, it's basically Sherlock Holmes
is anyone here
cab,
Mormon?
And then stuff happens, and then somehow magically he solves it. There's actually very little story there for Holmes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's because Conan Doyle did not really like Sherlock Holmes all that much. So,
yeah.
Like, the novels all are like, he's like, I want to tell this Mormon story. I guess I'll use Sherlock.
Right.
Okay. I want to tell these stories of this, you know, these the Indian Mutiny, I guess.
I would like to tell these scour stories in earlier panel, but when I first read A Study in Scarlet, I had it on my Kindle, and it was one of the free versions. And so I was like, oh, this is great. This is awesome. And I flipped the page, and I went,
the fuck?
Did I get two different books mushed together? I was like Googling the character names, like, what the hell book?
A lot
is
of
this
people,
in?
Like, actually, I worked at Barnes & Noble and someone came in saying, I think there's a misprint. And I was like, No. You can skip it.
Literally, nothing will change.
Nothing will change. Like, and the fact is, like, Conan Doyle's strength was in his short stories.
Right.
The novels are a bit too long
by the middle part that has a bit of in them.
The novels are. I don't want to write. I don't want to get paid for a short story right now. Let me take this short story idea and
make it
turn
a novel.
Into a novel.
The novels are too long by exactly the length of a non-Sherlock part.
Well, clearly he is.
The reason why they're bound is not because it's the only novel. It's really a full novel, but also it is the John Watson show. It's one of the only stories you really get to see John doing his thing, doing it reasonably well. I mean. He talks Baskerville off the ledge a couple of times.
Okay.
You know, he goes out and charges after a flaming dog. Sure, no problem, I got this.
That was a practical issue, too, though, because Hound was not meant to be a Sherlock Holmes story.
Right, exactly.
And he didn't want to put Holmes in there, and so he was like, well, I guess I can put Watson in there for most of it, you know, and I'll
Is that why he's not on screen most of the time?
Interestingly, filmmakers hate that, and they inevitably reintroduce Holmes early.
Yep.
In earlier versions, the earlier you go, the more Holmes there is,
yep.
And the later you get, the longer Watson is allowed to keep the story by himself.
Right.
And
wow.
That is indicative of our growing appreciation for how important Watson is.
Look
to
at that
Holmes.
Cyclical conversation.
There's a hand back there.
Yeah.
Going back a couple of when I love the point where you said if you start with the Study in Scarlet, it becomes Sherlock Holmes' story.
Mm-hmm.
Could you also argue it's just as much it becomes John Watson's?
Of course,
story.
Of course. That just didn't sound as good.
Because I think about some of the very interesting, you know, every version has their version of the reference of the stories we'll never hear, and I think part of the BBC Sherlock. That I think is fascinating is when you hear Lestrade talking about, I've known him for 5 years, and he talks about, you know, I think he could be good, he's a good man, or
one day he'll be a great one.
And I think that you get these insinuations that things have happened with this group of characters that John is finally coming into.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, that's the Study in Scarlet, is the starting off point for Watson. It's his rebirth,
yeah.
It's his start. Whereas, you know, Holmes has been in sort of the stasis in whatever situation has been going on with Lestrade for 5 years.
And the interesting thing to me about that is even though Lestrade has known him longer, as soon as John comes on the scene, like, he becomes the intermediary with Lestrade. Like,
yes.
let me translate from Sherlock for
right.
you. it's like, dude,
yeah.
You've known him for 5 years, and he's known him for 5 minutes.
Yes.
I mean...
Yes.
You
got a happy announcement at the end of the week.
Yeah.
You gotta
comment. Remember, Mycroft never lies. Every word as it's true. It's not necessary, you know, it's pretty misleading, but.
I'd like to go back to the whole growing appreciation for Watson and culture thing. If you look at
the recent movies with Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law, mm-hmm. you look at them, and it may not be your standard issue Sherlock Holmes, because, I mean, you look at the story, it's like, what is this here? but Watson is almost better than Holmes. He just, like,
yeah.
I remember watching the first one a few years ago, I was like, wow, I actually like Watson.
Jude Law's Watson is amazing.
Jude Law was a great Watson until Sherlock.
Honestly,
and then I was just like, well, okay, sure.
I think for those movies, it's like Sherlock is there so that Watson has something to react to.
The John Watson show. No,
actually BBC Sherlock does that a little bit too.
It's almost as if Sherlock has become that comic foil to the serious Watson.
Yes. We've come full circle.
We're this close to another clue.
Yeah, no, I think that's, and I think also talking about the PTSD thing, maybe it's not quite as extreme, but they really emphasize the limp, so you know that he has seen action, and I think that's also really interesting.
I agree.
Although he wasn't shot in the leg.
Well, are we going to go there?
No.
Ground rules, we're not going to talk about the limp.
Just to completely get off topic suddenly.
Great.
Talk about John Watson's wife.
Are you saying you want to talk about the man who has had the experience of women across three continents?
Three continents.
Many separate
because
nations.
I know that
continents.
I do.
But one of the things I hate, I don't like about the Morgan Freeman interpretation is that he's lousy with women. And I'm just like, no!
Okay, yes!
Come on!
Thank you!
Come on!
Oh
man.
My god!
He's getting way more play than this!
Wait! You don't have to be great with women and be a great ladies' man in order to have had a lot of experiences.
No, but
those not are mutually exclusive.
He's asleep and he gets a date with his boss.
Yeah, there's some baggage.
Okay, all right, fair point.
He is kidnapped by someone who controls all of London security, and his response is to try and pick up the girl in the car.
I assume
that John works on the assumption that, you know, if you make a pass of absolutely everything, it slows down.
And some of the things that don't slow down.
Only 1%, just don't have sex 5 times a day.
Okay. That's
my point.
To get back to the actual question here.
No, I think Martin Freeman's Watson is definitely a ladies' man.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay, that's a fair point. But as far as his wives are concerned, at least from a canonical perspective, he's only obviously married once. And then there's Stunning Scarlet.
I found you!
And then
I thought there was at least two.
Well, there's. He's never named.
Okay, so Stunning Scarlet says, Mary Morstan, you're awesome. I want to.
Or sign a four.
Right. Sign a four.
Then there's Scandal kind of Bohemia, where it's like, okay, you know, we're married. And this is my wife, Mary. After that, it gets really vague. the idea of the multiple wives came about as an attempt to make continuity make sense, which is insane and should never be attempted by anybody who's done
it. And isn't Arthur Conan Doyle's strong point?
Wife. There you go.
He had a common law wife at the beginning.
Right. I mean, at what point he has his wife call him James. It's just like, your wife doesn't even know your own name?
Interestingly, the radio adaptation starring Clive Merrison actually dramatized the death of Mary Morstan.
Yes, which I love. Oh, God, I love that adaptation. So the idea of multiple wives came about because of that. There's no canonical reference that he's married more than once. People look to Conan Doyle and say, well, he's married multiple times, and there's analogies there, so that's probably where it came from. And there's certain readings where it doesn't preclude him having married multiple times. I'm a fan of the one marriage idea because Watson makes a big deal of marrying someone and being domestic, and he values himself as a family man. You know, despite the fact that a lot of the stories are set in this bachelor era, both before and after his wife, he likes the idea of having a home and having a practice and being a part of that world. And to just not mention it and be, oh, by the way, Lowell's wife, just doesn't seem inconsistent with the characters being painted by the canon.
Well, I think one of the things that we see in canon and we also see in this, a little bit in the BBC version is, you know, he kind of wants to be normal.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, he's never going to get there, ever.
not the right he's
but
going.
He kinda,
he's walking down the wrong road.
He kind of wants that veneer of respectability.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, because the way it's phrased in the sign of four, when he's looking at Mary standing in the doorway with the other woman, and the light is falling out through the door, and these two beautiful, graceful women who, you know, they're so civilized. And he is in the cab with Holmes. 4 o'clock in the morning or whatever, and they are going off to have adventures.
Yeah.
I think that John very much wants to want what Mary represents.
He wants both.
Yeah, he wants to want. Yeah. And I think that comes across really nicely in the BBC adaptation, where John is in this constant ladder of, my life is chaos, and I wish I was more annoyed about that.
And I think it's where some of the queering Watson kind of comes from, is because there's some people read with the idea that he has protested too much, and they're going, I float to women, and we do all of this, women all the time, and I think some people's tradition is like, you're mentioning this a lot, Watson.
That just makes him an average guy, though.
Right, exactly. That's my point. My point is that that's just what dudes talk about, you know, and he's not even talking to Sherlock about it, he's just writing his diary about all the women he's looking for, awesome.
Since we got 15 minutes left, we should probably, I think, talk about sort of like the female Watsons.
Yeah, let's.
Because
yes.
there have been a few of them. Like Lucy Liu's Joan Watson is not the first female Watson. What is it, like Sherlock Holmes 1994? Or was it?
You're talking
Return of Sherlock Holmes
with Jane Watson, who was a descendant.
Yes.
Margaret Collins,
yeah.
There's also Robot Watson, who went to the 22nd century.
Yes, when he's a robot.
Okay, honestly, though.
But a male robot.
If you've seen the chart that shows all the depictions and they were, we were actually looking at this on the Three Packs podcast and realized that Watson has been an animal more times than he has been a woman.
And a vegetable. That's true, because there's
VeggieTales.
I know that one.
Tomato Watson's like really depressed. It's like really sad.
If I were a tomato, I'd be depressed.
It's true. No, but I think having a female Watson brings something very interesting to the dynamic, especially with the whole moral compass thing. I have no problems with it at all. I know some people do.
I
love it.
I started off going elementary because two birds would be terrible. I've grown to really like elementary and like Joan Watson. Joan Watson is not John Watson. That's what took me a while to get to.
She's not armed. That's fair.
There's no soldier training.
That's fair.
She's a very different character. But that being said, there is more sexual tension in Sherlock than there is in elementary. And I like that. I like the fact that this man and woman could just be friends.
Okay,
and it's refreshing.
Okay, but let's accept that the bar is kind of high there.
Well, yeah. Fair. But the point is that to look at any other American procedural with a man and a woman and find how long that's sexual tension. It's been
absolutely
18 episodes. Joan Watson has touched him once on the arm over a coat. That's it. I love that. I love that. And they have a dynamic, interesting relationship. It's not the canon, but it has some of the notes of the canon in it. She's his moral compass, but she's also his connection to reality in some respects, which Watson does in some interpretations, is that this is how the real world works, and let me kind of parse Sherlock into...
Well, she's the manager. I mean, we were talking about this in the last panel I was in, with the idea of there being this sort of postmodern idea of the Sherlock-Watson relationship, which is that our Sherlock is no longer this practiced professional, this paragon that Basil Rathbone was.
Right.
He is a child prodigy in an adult's body who requires some sort of a management. He is house. He can't function without a team. And very often that team is all rolled up into one really awesome John Watson.
Yeah.
But we have an evolution of that idea through our modern sort of 21st century adaptations with Jude Law, who just rocks as a person. You know, he's just an awesome human being who, you know, is great action man and does all these fantastic things. We have Martin Freeman, who really, I mean, I think Cumberbatch is... I mean, literally saves his life, right? Cumberbatch would self-destruct. Johnny Lee Miller has self-destructed.
Right. Yeah.
And we have somebody who is literally written in as a parental surrogate to manage him. So not only is she, it's like he's the child and she's the parent, she's literally standing in the beginning for his parent. Mm-hmm. So it's intrinsically written into the fabric. It's the continuation of this sort of evolving postmodern Sherlock Holmes Watson.
Yeah, we have someone back there being very patient.
I was going to say that actually my two big contentions with the Joan Watson character on Elementary are, number one, that they have taken the military service element out of the character.
Uh-huh.
Because not only is that a defining feature of Joan Watson, but in having a female Watson who is not a soldier and military hero, it's fairly blatant sexism. It's as if they're telling you
she's
not a hero and a soldier because she is a woman. And secondly,
the fact that she is his paid companion, I find very repulsive in terms of the Holmes-Watson dynamic.
But not anymore.
Not anymore.
It has changed.
It doesn't matter. It's how they met and it's why she was there to start with. And to me, it just casts a whole level of coercion and sort of forced companionship that makes it a very unpalatable way.
But although, she specifically elected
well,
to
although
be
if
his
you think
companion.
About it, the circumstances in A Study in Scarlet is also forced companionship.
Yeah,
right.
It is.
I mean, they move in together because
and
Watson...
a financial arrangement.
Yeah, it is...
But it's not that Watson is paid by a third party.
No, but it is a financial arrangement.
Actually, in studies, Sherlock makes a past very small comment to the effect of, yeah, I'll give you a small snippet. So, up what Sherlock actually paying for Watson.
But it's not
there.
A third party, and that's always going to be my objection.
Sure.
You're allowed to have that objection.
No, that's fine. The only other point I want to mention about the action part, which, again, I was with you. It's like, going, she's not a soldier, it's kind of sexist, blah, blah.
Get this away.
But over time, what's happened is that there's been lots of these subtle references of Miller's Sherlock saying things like, oh, she's two black belts in karate, and oh, she's masterful defense, and she's like, what? I had no idea. And because it's Lucy Liu, I think it's kind of a nod joke to this action film star is actually playing a character who can't do any of this stuff. And I think it's also a little bit of Lucy trying to find a new place in her career. So I think some of that's written with her in mind specifically.
Oh, and I was just going to go the opposite. I think they did a disservice to Lucy Liu in putting her in a character that does not have a military background. They're doing a disservice to Lucy Liu, and they're doing a disservice to Watson.
The impression I got from the interview
was she could have very easily been an army doctor in Afghanistan.
Sure.
And then
the impression I got from the interview with her.
To go away from that too.
We're like we were told to wrap up, and people have opinions, and I'm sorry.
That's a very good panel. Thank you.
We have a thing to give away.
Hey.
So Ashley's going to ask a question and raise your hand.
So here's your question. One of our most famous Sherlocks once played Watson, Jeremy Brett. Who was his Sherlock?
Charlton Heston.
Okay.
Yep.
There you go.
Charlton Heston.
Very bad Sherlock.
This quotidian world has got you crying, won't you too?